I belong to the race that in the Middle Ages was blamed for all the plagues. And such experiences have a sobering effect. And they do not arouse the tendency to believe in illusions. Much of my life has been devoted to trying to shatter illusions. But if there is an illusion worth believing in, at least partially, this is the illusion. That we learn how to divert the impulse of destruction from our own kind. How to stop hating each other because of trivial differences and stop killing each other for profits. That we stop taking advantage of the achievements of progress to control the forces of nature in a way that will lead to our destruction. Without this illusion, what future awaits us?
I found it in the collection of letters that Eran Rolnik translated to Hebrew. So I met it in the Hebrew version. And when I got back to German, something else happened. In the Hebrew translation, it was talk about the hope. Without that hope, it was about the hope. But then in the people in Vienna, in the sound studios, told me in German, this is not hope. This is illusion. And I thought this is even more powerful that it speaks about the power of illusion, the needed illusion. And it also brought me back to the beginning of my journey when a friend said the main purpose of the film is to have Freud telling us something like the Big Father. How should we live today? A tip from Freud, insight from Freud. So this is an insight from Freud, a message from Freud over time to us now. I'm not sure it's prophetic. I think there's no prophecies, but it speaks us now. It speaks us now.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Yair Kedar. Yair Kedar is an Israeli documentary filmmaker, and his current film is on Freud. It's called Freud, the Outsider. And as you hear in our conversation, he shares with us the struggle he had coming to find Freud. He said initially, when he tried to find Freud, all he found was his father. And both to address that and also to learn something about this treatment methodology, he spent time on someone's couch, which enabled him to get a sense of what the work is, and it also helped him to distinguish Freud from his father. And he had, he described, an epiphany of recognizing that Freud went through four periods, as he saw it, of challenges that he had to overcome, leading to there being four, quote, chapters in the film. And we go over those four chapters. But most importantly, this is not just a linear history of Freud's life. This has as much magic as it does history. He introduces 3D animation techniques. He uses surreal, dreamlike imagery. Is it real? Is it not real? The music is powerful, evocative, and a little unsettling in a good way, like a painting that's a little unrealistic can be unsettling in a very creative way. We have a, I think, an important conversation, not just about his life, but mostly about Freud's life. And his research is exhaustive, and he comes up with some discoveries, as it were, which he's modest to call them that because he doesn't want to vulgarize this effort with, you know, highlights and headlines. But he does discover things that are not well known about Freud, including the closing letter that he wrote to Romain Rolland, which is in the pull quote at the beginning of this. It's I think, important and powerful. To see the movie, you can reach him at his email address, which is listed in the show notes, and the website of the movie is also there. It was shown at the Viennese Freud Museum on January 9th of this year, 2025, and will be screened throughout the world over the next months and will end up on television at some point soon. But as I say, he can be reached, and he's a lovely guy, and I'm sure would want to share with you as much information as he can about how you can see this. He is, in addition to being an Israeli documentary filmmaker, he's a social activist and a former journalist. This is part of a project called The Hebrews, which he's been chronicling the lives of Jewish and Israeli figures of the modern Hebrew literary canon. And he's had 19 feature-length documentaries, and they've all premiered at film festivals around the world, and he has won over 30 prizes. He is also a leading LGBTQ activist. And as I say, his Wikipedia page and the films page are all listed on our show notes. If you can get to see the movie, I'd recommend it. It's only an hour of your time, but you will walk away, as I did, with a really refreshing sense of Freud, and not to mention admiration for the filmmaker. Here is my conversation with Yair Kedar. Yair, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you. Yair, it seems to me that faced with the opportunity to both write and produce a documentary on Freud's life, you have obviously a number of choices. One choice would be to write it mostly for a professional mental health community who are more or less familiar with his life, and you could do a linear construction, development of the arc of his life, filling in with details, and along with that could be matched up the conceptual and clinical evolution of his life. That would be one path. Alternatively, you could reach an audience that really doesn't know Freud in any detail, and you could provide them an immersive experience in this new space he helped uncover. An immersive experience in the world of the unconscious. And you could do that by sort of unsettling the observer in the way that fine creative art is creatively unsettling. It sort of changes our frames so that we begin to experience ourselves and the outside world differently. Or in Freud's case, he demonstrated for all of us that the barrier between our inner subjectivity and our perception of the outside world is far more permeable than we ever imagined. And I must say, and I hope this flattery doesn't make you uncomfortable, I think you combined the two of these masterfully. You do present a linear list of Freud's life, and you're going to share with us how you came to do that. But more uniquely, you used 3D animation, you used surreal imagery. You're not sure at times as a viewer, is it real, is it not real? And certainly the music you have in the background is evocative, elusive, at times transcendent. And throughout all this, you also bring forward the voices of analysts from around the world, from the States, from England, from Israel, from France, from Austria, as well as Freud scholars, also from around the world. Now, I want to start us off in the same way that you started your documentary off, and that is with a quote from Freud. This time it's in a letter he wrote to his then fiancée Martha Bernays, and it describes his experience of himself as an outsider, which you borrowed to title your film by that. And here's the way it reads in the film.
Dear Martha, do you really find my appearance so attractive? Well, I very much doubt that. I believe people see something alien in me. And the real reason for this is that in my youth, I was never young. For a long time, I have known that I'm not a genius, and I cannot understand how I ever could have wanted to be one.
Yair, the floor is yours.
Thank you for having me in the podcast. I'm very happy to talk about my new film. I spent the last 5 years with my film. And as for your comment that I would have like two possible scripts, two possible ways to make the film, I feel like as if I would have had a thousand.
Yeah. As soon as I said that, I thought that, yeah.
Yes, so many. And I do feel in each film that I begin that I have a thousand parts and I have to narrow down. So it's a long process of elimination. Now, I specialize in documentary biographies. This is what I do. And I try to find some way, some meeting points between the biography and what the artist or the thinker did. And those meeting points are always interesting because they're never like one-on-one. It's all the always make you, give you interesting connections, always. But when I was offered to do the film about Freud about 5 years ago, and I was very happy and thrilled because I thought it's going to be a very intriguing process. And quite fast, I found the film. And I found the film in a way that did not exist anymore. But I found the film and I thought of making it about celebrating 100 years anniversary to his article, The Ego and the Id, 1923. The film was supposed to come out in 2023. So I thought, how wonderful, I can make a film with the theme of the ego. I can talk about the return of the plague. Before 1923, you had the Spanish flu. 100 years later, we had COVID. So interesting repetition. And I also can talk about the ego in social media, which is like me, like, you know, it's the main language of the people today. But as the months passed, I noticed not only that the ego that I thought about is not Freud's ego. Ego in popular culture is not Freud's ego. That I'm not sure that I have anything interesting to say, something interesting about ego in social media. And that nobody wants to talk about COVID after it's gone. Hmm. I don't know if that's a complicated, interesting issue. So, and then I was, after 2 years into the making of the film, I had no film, but I had promises and funds and television, and I had to find my path. And also during these 2 or 3 years of the beginning, I began to notice connections between Freud and my father. My father and my mother were both Holocaust survivors as children. They both lost their parents. But they had a big thirst for life. And my father, around the age of 40, similar to Freud, began to make his hobby a profession, and coin collector, numismatist, which is small items in archaeology. And his house and his office was filled. He left my house, he had another house, was filled with his, with small, beautiful antiques, many, hundreds of them. And the red carpets, the smell of smoke, he smoked cigarettes in all of this furniture. So it's this strong memory of my father, and he passed away 9 years ago. And during the making of the film, the figure of my father and the figure of Freud became a little bit confusing to me. They enter into each other realms together with my confusion about how we're going to make the film. And then I had sort of like two angels or two people that opened the door for me and suggested me, gave me new hope. The first was Eran Rolik, who is a scientific advisor of the film and also a psychoanalyst. And he told me, use the couch. We have psychoanalysis. We have Freud. We have the, try it. See what it gets you. Maybe you will find solutions there. And that's what I did. I came to his clinic. I lay down for the first time in my life on the sofa, and we had just one hour. He was, I felt that it was like a witchcraft. He was so intense and precise, and he released my father a little bit. It was an opening of something. Later on, I did four more months of psychoanalysis with four times a week with another therapist, but something was open there. And another one is a fringe theater director who is Israeli, who lives in Vienna, who solves artistic obstacles in artists. And he guided me to think about this entanglement of Freud and my father, and showed me my artistic hope. This all happened in 24 hours. The next day, I went to walk on the beach in the morning, and I saw the film. And I saw the film as I saw it for myself, as the new Freud for my film, which is a Freud of overcomings, of challenges that Freud had several times in his life. And how can I tell his story as a person who faces challenges and then invents something, invents himself, invents solution? The solutions are not working. He will come back to the, he will fail. But I thought of his four moments of challenges and four moments when Freud decided to overcome these challenges. And it was a very beautiful moment, you know, after almost 3 years of losing my way, 24 hours, 1 hour in the sofa, the guy from Vienna, and a walk on the beach. And I began to see the film for the first time. And then I found the story, one of the thousand.
Yeah, my reaction to hearing it, and you've shared it with me before, not as fully as this, and it's very moving. You're really describing laying yourself open as best as you could at that time and discovering your truth, and your truth as it related to your father and how it became entangled with Freud, and you had help separating that. And with that, just as you describe in the film, by the way, after Freud's father died, there's an upsurge in creativity. And that seems to be very much what you're describing, that you found your voice, even to describe Freud, who undoubtedly carries some energy from your father, but it's your experience of Freud. And the freshness of the movie, that's another way to describe my take on it when I said about it's a little unsettling in a good way. The freshness of the movie could only have come from a fresh discovery within yourself. So I think whether we know that story or not, you communicate it to the viewer.
I believe I had an anxiety at the beginning. I was entering the path of making a film about one of the most known personalities in the world. And you have the professional circles, but you have large popular circles. You have hundreds of millions of people that have their own Freud. And I'm entering this field, and I have to find a way to tell a new story without new news, you know, evidence or new story. I have to find a story within, and then I can build it around it and think of how am I making a film that will not be a cliche about Freud?
Well, I can tell you, as somebody who had the privilege of watching the film multiple times, there's nothing cliche about this film. While most of the factual information was known to me, the way you bring it together is it's as if I'm meeting the man for the first time. So that's why I think you deserve my congratulations. The four challenges that you pictured in your mind Freud overcoming became what you call four chapters in the book. And I have quotes from each of those chapters, representative quotes, that just give the listener a sample of it. Let's start by outlining chapter one, and we'll get to the quote. Chapter one is called The Jew, 1878, and in it you describe, again in passing, his childhood. There's a very well-known story of dear Sigismund, the special boy in the family, when his daughters, his sisters, his parents' daughters, were in the home playing the piano, and it bothered him in his studies, and so he asked that they not do that, and the next day the piano was gone. One could spend a great deal of time on that. You don't. You just let the listener know that. You mention that. You mention his disappointment in his father for a host of reasons and his wish to make his way in the world. Again, he meets Martha. He gets involved in cocaine. He gets involved in self-analysis. And then you bring forward a quote having to do with the anti-Semitism of the time. And I will find that quote. Here it is.
Earlier today, Koller, the man who made cocaine famous, was on duty at the clinic. A dispute arose over some minor technical matter between him and the surgeon. And the latter then suddenly calls Koller a Jewish pig. Now you can understand what kind of atmosphere we live in here and how bad the situation is. I'm too agitated to write to you now.
Share with us chapter one.
From the four overcomings, the first chapter is overcoming the Jew, how Freud negotiated his Jewish identity and what power and strength did this grow from this experience. I was influenced here was Adam Phillips and his book Becoming Freud. In the film, I thought not about Freud acceptance or Freud postmortem, and not about the social, intellectual, psychedelic circles in his time. I was trying to follow his own experience, to have him on the couch, to imagine what Freud felt, to think about Freud in his time, in the moment, and then exploring the first chapter of his life. I was amazed by, I think it's called blatant anti-Semitism, racism in his childhood, in his youth. He grew up in the most anti-Semitic city in the world. It was very legitimate to talk about dirty Jews, to have racist remarks. And there is this quote about what he felt from this comment, and there is another quote in the film about a train ride. He rides to Martha, he rides the train, and he opens the window because it's too hot, and someone says, close the window, you dirty Jew. And then he won't, but then the conductor comes and then he closes the window. In the part of the letter that I didn't put in the film, he says, in the past, it bothered me, but now I'm okay with it. I'm fine. No problem for me. And I saw that this is very revealing. How can anyone find peace within himself in such an environment? So what is the extent of denial? What is the price that you pay? And I thought on this, where Freud is saying something but reveals so much more, I can have the chapter made around this.
You mentioned the train scenario, and we should note that the train leitmotif is throughout the film, from the very opening scene to the very closing scene. But of course, it's not just one train. That would be a different producer. It's multiple trains. Some are real, some are animated, some are magical. It makes reference to the well-known quote in Freud, where he instructs patients to imagine themselves simply in a train car, watching the thoughts in their minds go by like watching the scenery. But it's much more than that in your movie, and it really ties the movie up together, as I assume you intended. But it's again, beautifully done.
I think I gave a sort of narrative introduction, so we'll give like artistic introduction to the film.
Okay.
What are the artistic languages of the film? Introduction to the film. Come with me to the journey. So we have Freud letters. We have 26 Freud letters. very revealing. Some places you feel his denial, you feel his strengths, you feel the way that he thinks, you feel the way that he talks, and how does he react to situations in his life. We have 12 psychoanalysts and historians from five countries talking about Freud. And then we have the archives, home videos of Freud. Some were never seen in a film, were never shown in a film before because just digitized in the Library of Congress. And we had the rare opportunities to show it for the first time. We have archives from, we explored about 350 archival films from around the world from 1900 to 1925 to show and images that are showing his ideas. And we have two languages of animation. One, we animated unknown, less known dreams from the interpretation of dreams with Tal Cantor, the animators. So we created a language for just for the film, imagery of less known films from interpretation of dreams. And lastly, the last language of animation, it's like a Babylon Tower, but I think the languages speak between themselves, is recreation of the room, the legendary room, the house, Berggasse 19, the study, the sofa, the desk. This room does not exist anymore. We use the 140 black and white photographs of Engelmann from 1938, I believe, to reconstruct in 3D the room and to give the ambience and the atmosphere and the feeling. What was it like to be in Freud's room? So this is the sandbox. Yes, the film is a puzzle of all these techniques and languages, which are many for a film.
You just described in technical terms what I was sharing about just the experience of watching it and listening, about how there's a magical quality, and you had to do the work to make that, which you just gave us a taste of. But it will whet our listeners' appetite to see the film, and we're going to discuss how one can and can't do that. It's not meant to be a tease. Well, maybe it is meant to be a tease, but a tease we would like to satisfy. Is there anything more we need to say about chapter one?
It is becoming Freud. It makes some, and we introduce the mother and Martha also briefly. I think we see the mother in a home video.
Yes,
rarely seen. For this is the first time I saw Amalia Freud. It's very lovely to see this old Jewish lady. It's so famous, Amalia Freud. In the first time I saw her. So.
And then you start chapter two, 1900, called Freud Becomes Freud. And it's the richest chapter, it's the longest chapter with the most psychoanalytic type information. But where it begins, I think, is very special because you underline the importance of listening. That's Freud's great discovery. He studied with Charcot in Paris, and Charcot didn't listen to his patients. He observed them. He observed their theatrical performances of what he described and defined as hysteria. But he never asked them what their experience was. And Freud's genius was to return from that educational experience and look for more. And what he added was, let's listen to the patients, not just voyeuristically observe these strange physical expressions. And so it began. Do you want to pick us up from the listening?
I saw that listening, the unconscious, the psychoanalysis treatment were like the three things that blew me away, especially listening. You know, I had to list the innovations and ideas of Freud. And I thought this is one of the most powerful one. And how does it fit the modern era where people began to shift their focus on their, because there was no time and money, on themselves, on the individuality, and creating the subjectivity. And that conversation and listening are so powerful invention of Freud. So I thought it was amazing, and I used it in a very strategic place in the film as a main turning point for Freud.
This is one of the quotes that you introduced to alert us to the power of listening.
a secret. If his lips are silent, he chatters with his fingertips. Betrayal oozes out of him at every pore. I set myself the task of bringing to light what human beings keep hidden within, observing what they say and what they show.
When I say something about this beautiful quote, that we did something parallel, attempted to do something parallel in the filmmaking. Yes. So yeah. We watched the 350 archival films of the time, and we tried to have like a, I don't know, second glasses, or to see something else that what is shown there, to look for other levels. It's a very interesting way of viewing archival footage, very long one. But you have to focus your eyes and to look for the something other. And then you have this layer of the film when you have, it's, you know, the viewers cannot see the film now, but you have few instances of film that give you a sense of like off the beaten track, something that is not meant to happen in the film, something a bit weird, something different. So we were looking for that as the way to find a way that cinematic, archival, and contemporary, and historical, that will be similar to the other voice to which Freud paid attention to.
And as you've described, your intent was to show Freud in his time and not have us where we are looking back, but to appreciate the milieu. And there's, again, the immersion of the viewer is in Vienna of the time. The film and the sounds and the images are very much of Vienna, which allows that special immersive experience.
And that's something maybe a little bit improbable, because we cannot really see Freud without the time gap. Mm-hmm. But still there was an attempt to clear the outer noises and the time in between. And I think most authentic, or very, very authentic, was the letters, things but written more loosely at the time, and our archival of the beaten track footage that have no owner, they don't belong to anyone. They were in different circumstances. And it's sort of like a queer watching of materials. Hmm. Yes, I think so.
And in this chapter, you recount Freud's father's death. And let me play the quote you have on that.
I understand now that the death of my father is the most significant event, the most significant loss of a man's life. The death of the old man has affected me profoundly. I valued him highly, understood him very well. He had a lot of influence on my life, and I feel quite uprooted.
And that's quite a distance from the alienation he felt from his father as a younger man, if not a boy. The story of his hat being tossed off and him not being financially secure.
I think it's, you have here the regret, and you have the guilt, and you have the shame. It was surprising for me that the interviewees elaborated on this. Thought that this was much more than what I thought it would be. And also that they made a connection between Freud that begins to collect antiques, establishing his connection as a way to deal with his father's death.
That was one of the new insights from the movie that I had not put together. That is, it was after his father's death that he began collecting large numbers of statues, etc. And as you point out also, and one of your interviewees points out, that he touched them. Often he would be sitting with patients and he would keep one of them in his hands and caress the statue. And we don't know the meaning of that. One would consider nowadays, when listening to a patient and having a tendency to touch something and caress it, that it reflected some unrecognized feeling, gesture, desire towards the patient. But we don't know that, but we do have this link with his father.
I would guess that touching the statue would be better than touching the patient.
I don't think there's any question about that, but it, could, right. okay. it could represent that.
But I was very surprised to hear about the touching of the statue. Daniela Finti, who is the research director in the Sigmund Freud Museum in Vienna, talked about it. And I thought it was amazing. You know, touching and playing the surface of the antiques during the psychoanalysis, and this began my dealing with the film with a collection, and later almost all the others talked about the collection and how it was a reaction to his father's death. And it was something very powerful and very meaningful and very visual and very big. You know, it had 2,000 to 3,000 antiques. That's a lot. Yeah. That's a lot. Yeah. All around surrounding you, and the patient, you know, looks around and they see all these faces for all this cultural civilization looking back at him. It's significant. And also we found beautiful home videos of the collection, so we can use it in the film. And also I saw this remark about how significant the loss of his father was for him. That is the most significant event in the life of a man. This is also very revealing. You know, I lost both of my parents 6 months apart. I cannot say that the death of my father is the most significant. Someone can say that the death of the mother is the most significant. So other deaths. So it was very revealing to him, and giving more strength to the effect that this death had on him, which it was hard for him to handle, and found innovative ways to deal with. Probably.
And in fact, to jump ahead a little bit, when his mother does die, his comment is, "As long as she was alive, I would not be free to die myself," which is a complicated statement. It doesn't suggest the meaning of the loss of her, but the obligation to her to stay alive for her, presumably to spare her the calamity of losing her son. But we'll get to that in a little bit. In this chapter in the book, you then introduce Princess Marie Bonaparte, who becomes a major figure in his life, in his theorizing, and ultimately a saver of him, saved his life by arranging his escape from Vienna. Tell us about, and again, there's wonderful archive material on it. Tell us about the princess.
So you have the minor protagonist. So you have Freud's the main one. The other one will be the house. Yes, they're part of Bergasse. Uh-huh. His mother, Martha Freud, but also Princess Marie Bonaparte. Now, in many films, and you know, there's probably 150 films about Freud in the last 100 years, documentary and other, highly represented. Mm-hmm. And many describe his friendship with Louis-André Saloma. He's the most classical friend.
Yes.
But then I found during the making of the film, the other friend. She was a bit later in years. And her letters and correspondence with Freud were, I think 2 years ago, were open to the public after they were shut down in the archive. But Rémy Amaro is a historian from Lausanne that published them for the first time. And then you can see her side of the story. And you can see how dramatic and meaningful she was to Freud, as I describe in the film. Not only being a devoted patient, a good friend, a patron, financier perhaps, sometimes, of Freud, but someone who came in very crucial junctions of Freud's life, saved him from the Nazi, bought his correspondence, I think his fleece, saved some of the documents that he wanted to throw away, shared his love for dogs, bought him many, many antiques. And very importantly for the film, she's the main person to document Freud. She had a camera. So the home videos are her films. So she is the main person to document the legacy, the memory of Freud that we have is highly a gift to us from Marie Bonaparte. So I was honored to give her room in the film and to tell her story as like a secondary protagonist that comes to visit in every chapter. And now, Rémy Amaro published only a selection of letters. There are 8,000 letters, so some other day for some other filmmaker.
Let me share one of the letters that he does write to her.
There's no greater, richer, more mysterious subject worthy of every effort of the human intellect than the life of the soul. Psychology is surely the most glorious of all the noble ladies. Yours, Freud.
They shared this love, the love of the soul, psychology. It's needless to say complicated, she being a former patient, assuming there's such a thing, and how that played out, being a former patient, benefactor, lifesaver, friend. It's a complicated relationship.
Absolutely. And I think in some of the letters that I have read, it can be complicated. Yes, can be complicated and to reveal the later. The boundaries are fragile. Yes. Why I try to be non-judgmental, because the judgment towards the boundaries is completely contemporary.
Well, can you say what you mean by the boundaries are fragile? You say it in a way that it sounds loaded and you want to be careful. I don't know if I'm reading it right. What do you mean?
Oh, it's just I don't know enough about it. That's because I want to be... but there was something happening with her buying some items. He's not happy about the collection. He's not happy about it. And she sends her to buy other stuff. He's complaining. He's talking about her relation to money as a therapist while she's buying her item. So I just read a little bit about it, but I thought this is not much. It can not be part of my film. But I know of other instances, and that's really something for another film. But I thought also that if I will use one of those things, it will overshadow the whole film.
It would be gossipy.
Sort of gossipy, or we have this, we'll all get judgmental and cancel Freud. So let's not cancel. Let's just be with him carefully, hand in hand, showing some of his weaknesses without making harsh judgments. Yes.
Nicely said. Chapter 3 is entitled Love and Death, 1923. And you describe how momentous the early 20s were for him. His daughter Sophie died from Spanish flu in 1920. Her son Heinola died in 1923. He introduced the structural model, the ego and the id, which really turned the field upside down in a brand new direction. And of course, he received his cancer diagnosis in 1923. So it was a life-changing period of time. You want to share with us your discoveries of his relationship to all that?
So here, the first chapter is overcoming the Jew. The second chapter is overcoming the death of his father and inventing psychoanalysis. The third one is dealing with death and overcoming this multiple death coming from all sides. He also thought he's going to die at the age of 63. That's a lot of death. Freud's strategies to deal with death. And I saw this is maybe the most contemporary chapter in the film, because this is what I feel in the last year. Yes, we are in an era of death now, especially in the place that I come. So it was interesting to see how Freud was coping with his multiple death. He was coping it mainly by some denial, a lot of hard work, and adjusting the energies toward creativity in writing, which I thought it was fascinating and powerful. I think Dr. Sophie didn't die eventually from the Spanish flu, but complications connected to the abortion of her last child. So this is also insinuated in the film. But then, of course, Sophie, and then you had a grand study discovery the death of Hein, the discovery of cancer, and then later on, the death of his mother and his amazing reaction to the death of his mother.
Well, let me go back a little bit, because I didn't catch this in the movie, and it's a significant piece of information. The commonplace understanding of which I was... a follower of, is that Sophie died from the Spanish flu. you're saying that you have information that that's not correct.
Oh, yes. This is a bit abstract in the film. We didn't want to get into it too much, but it's complication that followed the abortion, actually, of the last child. But, you know, I don't know, this is not an hermetic environment. You have Spanish flu around. So it might be a mixed causes for death, but it is abortion that is involved there. And and also, you know, it is a very powerful death, but it comes, the full strength come with the death of Heinz, with the beloved son of the beloved daughter. And then this is a much stronger reaction. But he gets himself together, he pulls together and covers. Also another revelation of the film that he didn't use painkillers.
Yes, that was well known, actually, even to the end, right? But I just want to spend a moment acknowledging not the issue of how she died, the issue of how you're dealing with the information that how she died, because I think the temptation might be for a documentarian or a biographer to declare, aha, I found a piece of new information, and it's a little scandalous to boot, and I want to make sure everybody knows that I found it and everybody knows about it, and I want to honor your gentleness about it, your respect for the privacy, certainly of that time, but even of this time, not to italicize this event, but to put it in the context, yes, there was Spanish flu, and who knows, and let's move on. And I want to enjoy that way that you're dealing with it. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I think, but there's a certain temptation to vulgarize the picture, or to have certain facts which are gossipy or other.
Yes.
And it can overshadow the film. It's PR, it's accepted, etc. But it's not like a sensitive profile, and in order to be gentle and sensitive, you have to act gently and sensitive.
How easily that is forgotten.
But
as far as his not using painkillers, that was well known, and he did continue to smoke famously despite his jaw cancer, and he said he couldn't work without it, he couldn't think without it, which whatever psychological attributions one might be tempted to make, again, sort of in a gossipy spirit, there is a biology to the impacts of nicotine on brain functioning. And there's good biological reasoning behind it. Whether that explains it all isn't for us to say. But he did continue to smoke, and he did not use painkillers. And as far as I know, that was also true for the surgeries. Which were quite primitive at the time, were what we would call ghastly. And as far as I know, he did not use anesthesia.
But then it made the last morphine even stronger. And as I said, that in the background of this multiple death, I used very intimate archives, some of the home videos. And one of them is very moving to me. It's just a dinner. The first time I saw him eating dinner with his family and Martha, you see that he eats a bit weirdly because I think he had this thing in the
prosthesis.
And you see the dog, you know, and it's a little on the side. Maybe it was Yoffie, I'm not sure. So that's another way of creating intimacy, showing Freud eating dinner in Bergasa. The bourgeois family, yes.
There is a quote that you have from one of your analyst interviewees. When asked the question about, well, does psychoanalysis work? You know, we're talking about psychoanalysis and its profound discoveries, but there's also a question of, does it work? Does it change people favorably? And I was moved by his answer. And what he said was, it transforms how one loves. It transforms how one suffers. It lightens the weight of being. And I thought it was beautifully said. It does match my own experience on both sides of the couch. to accurately describe what it does. It can do more than that as well, if there is such a thing as more than that. But I did want to have that mentioned because we are talking about Freud, and we don't want to ignore the issue that he was a clinician. And what he was discovering was designed not just to be a fascinating understanding about how the mind works, but also a clinical methodology to help people live their lives more to their liking. And that's, I think, a beautiful way to describe it.
And I also invited the people interviewed, which is mostly a psychoanalyst. And I was, yeah. It's new to me, but, you know, the amount of years and energy that is spent of having the psychoanalyst treatment or becoming one.
Indeed.
It has to be very strong motivation and a very, very good reason, which I asked them to share. So this is what Fabrice Boulez shared. So this is why. And I said, this is very powerful. And this is also part of Freud's story.
Absolutely. And there is, and this is the final quote I have from the movie, something that did surprise me. And that was how prescient Freud was about the world we live in. And let me play it for you.
I belong to the race that in the Middle Ages was blamed for all the plagues. And such experiences have a sobering effect. And they do not arouse the tendency to believe in illusions. Much of my life has been devoted to trying to shatter illusions. But if there is an illusion worth believing in, at least partially, this is the illusion. That we learn how to divert the impulse of destruction from our own kind, how to stop hating each other because of trivial differences and stop killing each other for profits, that we stop taking advantage of the achievements of progress to control the forces of nature in a way that will lead to our destruction. Without this illusion, what future awaits us?
Each time I listen to that, I get tear-filled. It is so profound and, for me, surprising from him. It was a new way of thinking that I had never heard him represent. How did you come upon that?
I found it in the collection of letters that Eran Rolnik translated to Hebrew. So I met it in the Hebrew version. And when I got back to German, something else happened. In the Hebrew translation, it was talk about the hope. Without that hope, it was about the hope. But then in the people in Vienna in the sound studios told me in German, this is not hope. This is illusion. And I thought this is even more powerful that it speaks about the power of illusion, the needed illusion. And it also brought me back to the beginning of my journey when a friend said the main purpose of the film is to have Freud telling us something like the Big Father. How should we live today? A tip from Freud, insight from Freud. So this is an insight from Freud, a message from Freud over time to us now. I'm not sure it's prophetic. I think there's no prophecies. But it speaks us now. It speaks us now.
You know, you were careful as we were speaking not to use our worldview and assign it to Freud. And yet here we are, as we close, we get a message from Freud that applies to our world. He speaks so eloquently about the things he said. And of course, the reference to illusion is so powerful because illusion was such an important theme for him, the fight against illusions that he attributed to religion. But he said, you know, there is room for an illusion, one that will save us, not that one will condemn us. And yeah, I don't know if there's anything we can add after Freud's words on that. You've shared with us the pieces of you that led to this. You've given us a taste of how you've put this together. I'm going to talk to you about the really pressing issue, because if I was listening to this podcast, I would say, so great. So how do I see this movie? Hopefully, we will figure out a way that this can be seen, because this is important. This is important for a host of reasons. And I meant when I said at the beginning that I think what you've done has been masterful in taking the linear, but not limiting yourself to it, but not becoming rudely abstract, but gently fantastical, and with the delicate hand that I've come to know you, however briefly, is your theme. So thank you.
Thank you very much for hosting me. It's just a wonderful talk for me. It was a very meaningful film for me to make, and I hope to share it with many people as possible. And I'm extremely happy to share it with people from psychoanalytical circles, bringing Freud home.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.